Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Election Day was Tuesday, so we know who the winners and losers are, and everyone's ready to work together, right?
We've done this for over 200 years, and after these campaigns, we come together. And that's what we're going to do.
Oh, but how much has changed since then? Also this week, besides Florida's contest for U.S. Senate, the race for governor remains up in the air, and some allege there is a racial element involved.
As African Americans are moving into those higher level positions, there has historically always been some level of pushback.
We'll also bring the Capitol Report reporters together to talk about the latest in the ongoing recount crisis that seems certain to envelop the state, at least over the next week or so. And we'll wrap up the show taking a dive among the endangered coral forests off the Florida Keys. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. We start off this week's program with some reports from around the state in the immediate wake of Tuesday's election. Later, we'll bring you up to speed on the very latest involving some of the highest profile contests in the electoral cycle. It seemed as though the tight race for U.S. Senate was a done deal on election night. Governor Rick Scott was out to unseat incumbent Senator Bill Nelson. WGCU's Rachel Iacoboni was at the presumptive victor's watch party.
Scott took the stage nearly 5 hours after polls closed, to the applause of an enthusiastic and patient crowd of his supporters.
If you just stop and think about it, from what we started to deliver 8 years and 7 months ago, it's just hard to believe we're here tonight.
The term-limited governor anxiously awaited the results over the course of the night, until his campaign ruled Scott's lead over Nelson large enough to call it.
The campaigns I've been involved in are divisive and they're tough. And they're actually way too nasty. But you know what? We've done this for over 200 years, and after these campaigns, we come together. And that's what we're going to do.
Scott spoke about his next steps heading into the majority Republican Senate, now facing a Democratic-led House.
Together, we reinvented state government in Florida, and we're going to do the same thing in D.C. The federal government is frustrating. It's outdated. It's wasteful, and it's inefficient. All of us in state government have dealt with the federal government over the last 8 years, and we could tell you story after story after story.
In his own sort of rags-to-riches story highlighted in past campaign ads, Scott rose from the economic hardships he faced as a child to put himself through law school and later apply his education and his role as the CEO of the largest for-profit hospital in the country, where he made the millions he'd one day invest in his bids for public office. When he spoke about his upbringing, Scott choked up at the mention of his mother.
She never would believe that I'd be a governor or a U.S. senator. I had the most wonderful mom.
For voters, the most important thing leading up to Election Day seemed to be the two senatorial candidates' responses to crises such as the algal blooms plaguing the southern half of the state. The topic was front and center on protest signs in the months leading up to the midterm election. Another hot topic was the response to Hurricane Maria's devastation in Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico, Puerto!
Scott visited the so-called Isla del Encanto 8 times after Maria, though Nelson also visited the island several times. With all of the causes that are near and dear to the hearts of Florida voters, in the end, they declared they want a new, though familiar, face to take a crack at solving the state's biggest issues on the Senate floor.
And I will never give up. God bless every one of you. God bless our great country. Let's get to work.
I'm Rachel Iacoboni in Naples.
Certainly, Florida's U.S. Senate contest isn't the only bone of contention right now. On Election Day, Andrew Gillum narrowly lost his bid to be the first black governor in the state's history, as well as being the first Democratic governor in 2 decades. WLRN's Jessica Bakeman spent the last few days of the campaign with Gillum supporters in Tallahassee.
For the Gillum campaign, Election Day started at midnight with a rally and concert at Gillum's alma mater, Florida A&M University. The school's marching band opened for headliners P. Diddy, DJ Khaled, and other celebrities pulling for a Gillum win.
We gonna get Andrew Gillum in office tomorrow! Y'all ready?
The joy and pride Black Floridians felt about Gillum's candidacy was palpable during two Election Day parties at Florida A&M, the state's only public historically Black university. Hours after the concert, the Gillum campaign and supporters waited for election results on the campus's main courtyard. Kiara Ware is a FAMU junior from Fort Lauderdale.
We voted, we early voted, we voted today, we voted in the grand ballroom, we voted everywhere.
3.9 million people voted for Gillum. He lost to DeSantis by 1%. Andrew Gillum ran his campaign for governor on both of his hometowns.
Growing up in Miami.
Gillum said his childhood in the Richmond Heights neighborhood of South Miami-Dade informed his platform. Funding for public schools, affordable health care, better economic conditions for working people. His other home is Tallahassee, where his record as mayor plagued his campaign.
I'm proud to be the mayor of Tallahassee.
But Republicans criticized the capital city's crime rate and highlighted an FBI investigation into potential corruption in city government that's still swirling around his administration. During the contentious campaign, the candidates accused each other of being radical, extremist, liars. And race was at the forefront.
The last thing we need to do is to monkey this up.
He understood the dog whistle that he was blowing.
DeSantis has maintained he is not racist. He said everyone in Florida would get a, quote, fair shake if he was governor. Gillum embraced his status as the first Black major party candidate for governor in Florida, especially in how he spent the final days of his campaign with what he hoped would be the celebratory events at Florida A&M.
Bring it home! Bring it home!
After voting on the morning of Election Day, Gillum was asked to comment on the historic nature of his run.
We'll worry about history later, but today we're working to win.
Voting with his wife and three small children, he seemed comfortable, calm, confident. 13 hours later, he was holding back tears during his concession speech.
I sincerely regret that I couldn't bring it home for you.
He stressed that he would keep fighting for the things he and his supporters believe in. Florida has a dark history of slavery, institutionalized racism, and racial violence. Reginald Ellis is Associate Dean of the Graduate School at Florida A&M and an expert in African American history. He says Florida's past affects what happens today.
As African Americans are moving into those higher level positions, there has historically always been some level of pushback.
He argued that during this campaign for governor, racism from the GOP was overt and profound. Some Black voters said they were impressed by how Gillum embraced his identity and called out racism.
So often people are afraid to tackle racism.
Erica Horn volunteered for Gillum. She's from Deerfield Beach and lives in Tallahassee now.
I felt like I was being heard every moment that he spoke. He actually spoke for me.
Another campaign volunteer, Ursula Staten, said Gillum's campaign was historic even though he lost.
It's a start, you know. We've never even had a nominee.
She said she believes he helped create opportunities for other Black candidates in the future. I'm Jessica Bakeman in Tallahassee.
But wait, there's more. About 200 people crowded into a North Fort Myers restaurant on Tuesday night to support two Republican candidates at an election watch party. WGCU's Andrea Perdomo was there, too.
At a viewing party for himself and the nominee for the 79th Florida House District, Spencer Roach, Matt Caldwell took the stage to make a speech before several counties had finished reporting election results.
We're looking like just over a half a point, so we're outside the recount zone. I'm going to go ahead and call it. I'm going to say that we're the next Commissioner of Agriculture.
Caldwell faced attorney and lobbyist Nikki Fried for the cabinet seat. The Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services oversees 19 departments, including concealed weapons licensing.
Hopefully, 60 days from now, we'll be sworn in as commissioner and be responsible for the things you heard me talk about the last 2 years on the road. What I've committed to you on the trail, you're going to see me commit to you in that office.
Over an hour after the Caldwell campaign called the race, it was announced that he had won by just over 39,000 votes. Caldwell said he was the first person from Lee County to nab a state cabinet position since 1947. I'm Andrea Perdomo in North Fort Myers.
Still to come on Capitol Report, now that we've heard how some of Florida's biggest political races were looking on election night, we'll find out how the tectonic plates have shifted since then and how they may continue to bounce around for some time to come.
That hearing is happening now as we're speaking. We'll wait to see what the outcome of that is.
And some scientists have come up with a new way to halt the spread of disease in undersea coral colonies. It's very similar to how a fire break halts the spread of wildfires.
When the pathogen continues to kill tissue, once it reaches that place where there's no more coral tissue, it will burn out because there's no way that it can get beyond that to the rest of the colony.
As we continue our special Capitol Report, looking back not only at the election, but also looking back at all of the factors that are likely to cause some additional problems with that election, at least for the foreseeable future. And we're joined by Ryan Daly and Regan McCarthy, taking a look at the outflow from the beginning of the program where we had that overview of the U.S. Senate race, the governor's race, and also the race for Florida Agriculture and Consumer Services Commissioner, all of which are up in the air right now. And as of late afternoon on Friday, Regan McCarthy, where do we stand with these races?
Right, Tom. All of those three races you mentioned, the U.S. Senate race, the race for Florida's governor, and the race for Florida's agriculture commissioner, are within the margin for a recount. And so to be within that margin, they have to be less than one half of 1%. So all of those are there. Two of them are within the margin that would demand a hand recount. So they're closer to each other than a quarter of 1%. But the recount process and how that works is that people will turn, election supervisors will turn in their counts to the Secretary of State on Saturday by noon. And then the Secretary of State will look at those and he will call for those recounts if they fall within those margins, if they stay where they are now. And even those ones that are within that margin for a hand recount, the first thing that will happen is that a machine recount will happen. And then after that's completed, then if there's still that margin within a quarter of a percentage point, then those races will go to a hand recount.
Wonderful explanation of the process, but that leaves the burning question. What the heck happened? It looked like as of election night, Rick Scott was going to be the next U.S. senator. Ron DeSantis was going to be governor of Florida, and Matt Caldwell was going to be the next commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services. What happened?
Yeah, well, and that's really interesting. So one of those races that you just mentioned, the race for Florida's agriculture commissioner, has actually flipped since we had our election result and since, you know, people called it on election night. So at the end of election night, Matt Caldwell said he thought he was going to be the agriculture commissioner. He thought he had enough votes. At this point, actually, he's trailing Freed by about 3,000 votes. So that's a pretty surprising thing. I talked to a political science professor, Susan McManus, about how frequently something like that happens. And she says, really, that's a very unusual for a race to flip like that in a recount. Often what a recount is for is to help us as voters know, all right, you know, we know this race came down really close. We know that you might have had some questions about it, but, you know, we're good with our democracy here. We've double-checked it, and this is who the winner is supposed to be. And I think a lot of that comes down to what we're seeing happening in Broward County and also maybe some in Palm Beach County. But I know in Broward County, they're still counting votes. And that's where these differences are happening and where some of this wiggling is going on. Ryan, I know you've been sort of following the case about what's going on in Broward County. Fill us in on that.
Right, yeah. And so what we're talking about is a number of lawsuits that have come into play. And I think it helps to give you the mental picture of, you know, those what's going on with those lawsuits, to lay it out in chronological order. So last night, Rick Scott held a press conference at the governor's mansion. He announced that, among other things, like petitioning Florida Department of Law Enforcement to launch an investigation, which it sounds like has not actually been launched. He also filed a lawsuit against Broward County and Palm Beach County Supervisors of Elections. Basically, the ask from the Scott side of things, they are wanting the information from Supervisors of Elections that they say they're entitled to, like the number of votes, you know, still out there, things of that nature. And, you know, during the hearing, which I caught the beginning of, the lawyer representing Scott said that they Nelson's campaign would have access to that information as well. So they're saying it's not partisan. We would both get that information. Now, different lawsuit. Senator Nelson has filed a lawsuit of his own, and the objective of that suit is to extend the deadline for Supervisors of Elections to turn in the unofficial numbers to the Department of State. And again, a recount cannot begin until those unofficial numbers have been, you know, finalized. So, and in that Nelson lawsuit, that he's asked the federal district court that's handling it to make an expedited ruling so that, to quote them, the no voters are unfairly and arbitrarily disenfranchised.
Okay. And then on top of everything, President Trump jumps in today and says that he is going to send at least one lawyer to Florida to get involved in this somehow, even though it's not a presidential election. So will that further complicate things, or what's going to happen?
I think that's left to be seen, Tom. You know, I think this is something that the whole country is watching. And I think there's a lot of frustration coming from different people in different areas. There are definitely some unusual things happening. The lawyer working for the Nelson campaign has talked about this unusual layout for their ballots that has caused a higher than normal number of undervotes, meaning situations where people have not voted for that Senate race. Generally, people vote for those big races, the Senate, the governor. And so it's unusual that there are a lot of ballots where somebody didn't vote for that race, and they think maybe that has to do with the layout. There was a situation at a Broward County high school where a teacher found a big box of provisional ballots there and had to call into the election supervisor's office. And so, you know, those are being tallied now. That seems weird to people. Also, you know, people just... they want the answers. They want to know what is the outcome of this race. And I think they're feeling frustrated that they don't have that information right now. But something to keep in mind is that Florida law doesn't expect to have those answers until Saturday at noon. Saturday at noon is when election supervisors are supposed to turn their information in to the Secretary of State. Many of the secretaries have already done that, many of the election supervisors have already done that. But because, you know, just the mere fact that Broward County hasn't done that or some county hasn't done that doesn't mean that something illegal is happening.
And it is likely to continue here for at least several more days past Saturday as we go through this recount process, which is very strictly governed by Florida law.
Right. And as Ryan pointed out, one of the lawsuits that's up in the air right now is that lawsuit to extend that Saturday deadline. So right now we're working on the assumption that that deadline is Saturday at noon. The Nelson campaign wants Supervisors of Election to have more time to turn in what are called those first unofficial results. And so that, as Ryan said, that hearing is happening now as we're speaking. We'll wait to see what the outcome of that is.
Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, and I think it's important to add, and I should have added before, that there is another lawsuit in the mix, and that pertains to the race for agriculture commissioner. Republican candidate Matt Caldwell has seemingly kind of piggybacked on the Rick Scott lawsuit as he is now suing Broward County. And what's significant about that race is that is the only race that, at least at this point, appears to have flipped to the Democratic candidate, that's Nikki Freed. And a lot of – one thing that I'm seeing a lot of, you know, the Capitol press and other reporters around the state kind of comment on is that Republican votes are being added as well. So Rick Scott's vote total, Ron DeSantis' vote total have gone up as well. They're just going up at a slower clip than the Democratic candidates because you're talking about blue – counties in Palm Beach and Broward County.
And with all these moving parts, things are likely to change again and again and again. And so watch this space. Regan McCarthy and Ryan Daly, thanks for joining us here on Capitol Report.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for having us.
The man accused of sending pipe bombs to prominent critics of President Donald Trump has been indicted on charges carrying a potential penalty of life in prison. The 30-count indictment in Manhattan federal court was filed today against Cesar Sayoc. Sayoc was arrested in Florida on 5 charges carrying a potential sentence upon conviction of nearly 50 years. None of the devices, some of which arrived at New York addresses, exploded. A message left with Sayoc's lawyer was not immediately returned. Sayoc appeared in New York earlier this week. He was being held without bail. Prosecutors say evidence against him includes DNA linking him to 10 of the explosive devices and fingerprints on 2 of them. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, for the last couple of years, scientists and divers in South Florida have been watching as a new disease has been spreading among Florida reefs. It's a waterborne pathogen that kills stony corals. They're the big ones that serve as the foundation for the reefs. Scientists don't know what caused the outbreak, but they do know that the number of different kinds of corals it attacks and the rate they're dying from it is unprecedented. But so is the response. WLRN's Nancy Klinginger talked to Andy Bruckner from the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary about what scientists are doing and what anyone who dives can do to help.
There's a relatively new disease affecting the reef here in Florida. What is that disease?
We're calling this stony coral tissue loss disease. This is something that first started in the Florida Reef Track off of Miami near Virginia Key in 2014, and since that period, it has continued to spread through the reef system.
We've been hearing about diseases on the reef, at least here in the Keys, for decades. What makes this one different?
Coral disease was first identified in Florida back in 1972. This particular disease is very unusual because it affects more species of corals than we've ever seen before. It has what's called a prevalence, the percent of the colonies within an area that become infected when the disease first shows up is much higher than you see with other types of diseases, and also a very high proportion of those die from this disease.
Which corals does it affect particularly?
Stony coral tissue loss disease has been observed in 22 different species of corals right now, which is just under about half of the reef-building corals that you find within the Florida Keys. This includes a lot of the big boulder corals, some of what we call the big important frame-building corals, like the mountainous star coral, for instance. It includes species that are listed on the Endangered Species Act, things like the pillar coral. But what it doesn't affect are 2 very, very critical corals to these reefs, what are known as elkhorn coral and staghorn coral.
The mountainous corals, the framework builders, they're really sort of the foundation of the reef?
Yeah, so that's what's really most concerning about this disease, is the fact that it's hitting some of these corals that have built the structure. The reef that you see, that reef was built by the skeletons of these particular corals. Corals, especially the frame-building corals that are building these reefs, can live for hundreds of years. Some of the very large corals that you see that are, say, 6 to 8 feet tall and 5 or 6 feet wider or larger, some of those may be as old as 500, 600 years old. And the mountainous star coral and the lobate star coral are 2 of the most important frame-building corals that you find here in Florida and throughout the wider Caribbean.
And you're actually going out in the water and treating this disease. How does that work?
When you see this disease, it looks like a line or a band. You can see the dead skeleton, and that's immediately adjacent to live tissue, and the diseased area is that interface. And so we can cover that interface with underwater epoxy or clay, and that material is treated with something. We can use an antiseptic, like what they use in a doctor's office to clean all of your utensils and the tables and everything else. So we can put chlorine powder is one of the things that we're using, where we mix that in with the epoxy and then place that on top of the diseased tissue, and that will eradicate it. And we also have come up with a very, very effective mechanism where we take a broad spectrum antibiotic and we mix that in with either a silicone base or shea butter, something it's basically a lotion that you're using. And then we use a syringe and apply that right on the diseased tissue. There's one other approach that we're doing as well, is something that we call trenching, where we have the disease moving across a colony, and a few centimeters ahead of that disease line, we will make a groove or what's similar to like a fire break in that coral will excavate away a little bit of the tissue so that when the pathogen continues to kill tissue, once it reaches that place where there's no more coral tissue, it will burn out because there's no way that it can get beyond that to the rest of the colony.
Could divers be accidentally helping to spread this disease? And if so, what can they do about that?
So there is a potential for divers to spread the disease, mainly if this is a waterborne pathogen. Just by getting into the water, we know that bacteria and other microorganisms tend to stick to neoprene and silicone materials, and so it can attach to your wetsuit. If you're in an area where there's a disease outbreak, those areas potentially have a much higher amount of this pathogen in the water column, or if you touch some of the corals accidentally, you could then carry that particular pathogen, and when you go diving in another area that's not infected by this particular disease, it could then be released into the water and start affecting those areas. The most important thing is that when you come up from a dive is that you make sure you clean your gear and remove all the debris. If there's any seagrass or algae or anything on it, that you get all that off and you don't dump that in the water in some other location. And then at the end of the day, especially if you're going to a new country or another region on the reef, that you wash your dive gear with a solution that is known to get rid of some of these bacteria.
You're also asking divers to report if they see the disease, right?
The problem that we have is the Florida reef trek is extensive, and scientists can only dive so many locations, and a lot of our monitoring that goes on only occurs once per year, and so we don't have a lot of information at certain times of the year, especially like during the winter, for instance. And if people see the disease and they report it, they help us identify places that we either need to get in the water and do interventions, we need to get more scientific information, or do other steps to better protect and manage that particular reef environment.
There's so much bad news about coral reefs with the bleaching and the effects of climate change. How do we not give up hope for our reef?
I believe that we have a lot of opportunities here to protect reefs and to revive them in places where they've been damaged. We're doing a lot of novel techniques in restoration. One of the biggest concerns affecting coral reefs worldwide is climate change. But what we've learned is that corals are able to adapt to some of these stressors over time, as long as other factors that are contributing to their demise are minimized. And so our philosophy is that if we do whatever we can on a local scale to reduce human impacts, the environment and the water quality will be better, and those corals will be stronger, and they'll be able to better tolerate some of these global stressors.
Well, thanks so much for talking to me today.
You're very welcome.
That was Andy Bruckner from the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary talking with WLRN's Nancy Klinginger about a disease that's severely impacting Florida's reefs. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.